Shasta is surprised that they're brother and sister and not husband and wife.
Ruling Narnia as siblings.
That's so ingrained and into the mythology of this world at this point. But for Shasta, it's new.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this
is Talking Beasts.
Hello everyone, welcome back. I'm Rillian.
I'm still Glumpuddle.
And we have a great episode for you today. We're going to go over the comments section, talk about some of the stuff you guys posted on the last episode about whether Narnia is racist or not. And then we're going to discuss chapters 5 and 6. We're going to meet the Pevensies again. We're going to go over a he-she moment in The Horseman's Boy of how it should have ended, potentially, or a cinema sin, as it might be called. We're going to go over another creepy moment, not another, but really a very creepy moment in The Horseman's Boy, and get inside some of the thoughts of our main character. And towards the end, we will have, again, some of our special segments for you to listen to. And finally, Glumpuddle will or will not be stumped.
Well, we'll see.
Are you ready for your stump question, Glumpuddle?
Give it to me now.
Because I'm such a nice guy, I will let you mull over this for the entire episode, unlike what you let me do last time, where you just sprung it on me at the end.
That was your fault, though. I tried to be a nice guy.
You know, whataboutism and just shifting blame. It's just, you know, logical
just
fallacies.
Give me the question.
Okay, here's your question. In Chapter 10 of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Lucy is reading the Magician's Book and encounters a story that she says is the loveliest story she has ever read or ever will read. When Lucy tries to reread it, she finds she can't turn the pages back, and when she tries to recall the story, she finds that she's already forgetting it. However, there are four story elements that Lucy is able to remember. What are these four story elements?
Awesome scene. I think I could get at least three of them, but I'll mull this over.
I know. I was in the same place. I thought.
I don't know if I can get the fourth one.
Good one. This is a good one.
But that's such an awesome scene of, well, we've already done that chapter in a previous book commentary, so we should go before we shift directions too much.
Indeed. So after the last episode, you know, we discussed Tashban and the Calorman culture, and we got some good comments, a lot of discussion, actually. Which we'll continue to get to.
And it was all really mellow and not a lot of controversy.
You know,
it was all very...
It was very laid back. In fact, there were no exclamation marks, no question marks, no caps.
No passion whatsoever.
No emotion whatsoever.
Certainly not in the Facebook group.
Anyone wanting to know what a bunch of Vulcans discussing Narnia Web looks like, you should go and just see this last sampling. Anyway, you know, Wagga Werewolf 27... basically said, you know, she thought Tashban basically it's the overcrowded city. You know, you look through culture, you have cities like Byzantium, which is before Constantinople. You have these just basically these giant, big, important cities in politics, and kind of like I think she was saying that's, you know, a huge part of what it was, and in this story and the role and how it's kind of tied to other cities in history. And then Eustace says, and I really love this, Eustace says, I really just want to see Erebus wearing Indian Bollywood-style dresses while visiting La Seraline. And I'm thinking, yes, that's exactly how I read this.
Well, it's so funny, the number, and I was having a conversation about this with Twigs over the weekend, and I had a few Narnia Webbers over at my house, and so many Narnia Webbers specifically mentioned, no, like, La Seraline and has to have this, you know, or Erebus and Lazarus, they have to have this Bollywood style dress, and that's just such an image that's in people's minds. And even though we talked about in the last episode, oh, the whole kind of Eastern aesthetic of the Calormans, that's not crazy essential. They could change that if they have to. But at the same time, as a fan, for a lot of people, it's no, I really, it's like if the Dawn Treader didn't have a purple sail. Does it really matter? No, but yes, it does at the same time.
So now you're saying it does matter.
I'm saying I understand. Because look, for me as a fan, yes, that whole like me, like you talked about hearing the gladiator music when they enter Tashban. I hear Lawrence of Arabia for obvious reasons. And that whole feel is very ingrained into me in the way I kind of think of the horse and his boy. But when I go, well, at the end of the day, they have to tell a story. And I don't think the kind of Middle Eastern aesthetic is absolutely essential to the horse and his boy. if it's going to be an unnecessary distraction, well, just lose it.
And, you know, I think there's kind of there's multiple schools of thought on this in the Narnia community. One would be, I might be called a purist. I might be someone who, like, you know what? I really want this story that's the written in this book to be experienced on the silver screen. And then there's others who think that having aliens in Narnia is okay. And you know what? If that's your cup of tea.
That's not what I said.
Okay. You texted me and said, what if... Let me read your text. Here, you start talking and I'll pull up that text. Because I did not respond because I didn't know how to respond. I didn't want to just say, aliens are a bad idea, you know, go back to sleep.
Not alien. Okay, you're okay. You're trying to be funny now. Trying. Someone floated the idea of, you know, we're talking about different ways you could handle the issue of perceived racism in The Horse and His Boy. And, do you just not have white Narnians and darky Calormans? Do you maybe just have everybody be white? Or do you maybe have mixed ethnicities? You know, what do you do? And someone said, well, what if they weren't even human? And for the record, what I meant was something like a Marsh Wiggle or maybe even like Jadis, where it still kind of looks like a human at first glance. And so I was just wondering, and that made me think, well, that would be quite a departure from the book. In the last episode, I just said, oh, this whole Middle Eastern thing doesn't really matter ultimately. How far could we take that, though? What would fans do? And so I asked, well, how would you all feel about non-human Calormans if they were to do that? How would you all feel about that?
For the record, that was your question in the text. You said, what if the humans were not Calorman? What if the Calormans were not human? And my mind instantly went to purple aliens.
Well, I think a lot of people went to, like, talking beasts or minotaurs or something like that. But either way, it was more just, oh, I wonder how fans will react to this. And they overwhelmingly said no. I mean, for the record, I voted for there were a few different things you could vote for. I mean, one of them was
I voted no.
You know, no is the one.
Yeah,
the exclamation
that's the one
point.
I voted for.
That's the one that won. That got like 90-something% of the vote. And I voted for doesn't seem like a good idea. I'm not 1,000% closed off to it, but yeah, It just seems like it probably wouldn't work. And so that was the intention behind it, just to see. Okay, I felt like in the comments section on the website, I felt like most people were agreeing that, okay, this isn't absolutely essential, this whole Middle Eastern aesthetic. You can tweak this. You can reimagine the Calormans a little bit. It's not that big of a deal. And I wondered, well, how far would the fans let the movie go with that? Some people immediately thought I was crazy. We had some comments from RJ and Bartek and Marcus who were just went, why would you even bring this up? Then you had people like Natalie who at least understood kind of more of the issue of what was perceived as racist at the time versus what's perceived as racist now.
Well, and I did have to laugh. I don't remember who it was saying Narnia Web used to be a place with good discussion. I'm like, oh come on, you know. And in your defense,
I'm sorry for subjecting you all to my little social experiment. Well, let's say that.
And it is an experiment. And if I can defend you here, if there is a person in this discussion who is more in tune with the script writing or filmmaking process, it's absolutely Glumpuddle. Not just because his career is tied to that industry, but and he does this type of stuff professionally. But Glumpuddle does understand, and you get how script writers think. And even though I did not like The Last Jedi, I actually thought Rian Johnson gave a fabulous description one time of just the script writing process. And he was saying, you know, sometimes he said, you really have to just try all kinds of things in your imagination just to see what will work and what doesn't. And sometimes you might try something crazy and you realize that there's a little part of that actually was a good idea. He goes, I thought about making Rey a robot in The Last Jedi and realized that was a bad idea. But I thought, and he wasn't seriously considering, but I thought, you know, okay, this is what Glumpuddle is doing. Is he's just saying, hey, what if we just consider this? How, you know, I think it might be a bad idea, but how well would it work in terms of just discussion and exploration? And I think that's kind of what you were doing with it.
Yeah, and so, that's a reason,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I was trying to be funny, and I was trying to, you know, at your expense, which I'm not sorry for. But
oh, I'm used to it. Don't worry. But
yeah,
I mean,
on this show.
Yeah, but a lot of my favorite movies have things that sound like terrible ideas, but they managed to, but they executed it well. But I mean, I feel like I want to make it clear here that I'm not overly concerned about The Horse and His Boy having to be politically correct. And what I mean by that is, either way, like The Horse and His, as a few people pointed out, they can't win. Leading up to the release of this movie, 2000 whatever, if and when it happens, there's going to be people saying, one way or the other saying this is racist. Either they're going to say, look at this degrading betrayal of the darkies, you know, the bad darkies versus the white Narnians, or they're going to be saying, oh, they've whitewashed this production, like with Ghost in the Shell, What was the Matt Damon one, the Great Wall or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Either way, as far as, you know, the internet blog scene, you can't win, and whatever, I don't really care that much. I'm much more worried about distractions within the movie itself. And I think if you have that strong Middle Eastern aesthetic to the extent you have it in the book, to me, that's an unnecessary distraction. I think it would be a much greater distraction in a story in 2000 something than it would be in 1954 when Lewis published the book. Just like how, you know, there's the bit in The Silver Chair where Puddleglum says, let's all be gay. We should all act gay in order to fool mm-hmm. the giants into thinking we're happy to be here. Now, yeah. In 1953, of course, that meant happy. When readers read that, they read it as happy. But now, because culture's changed in the past 50, 60 years, that word means something different. So this isn't about fixing the book. It's about saying that the book was, we want the book to have, you talked about the experience of reading the book. And I would like modern moviegoers to have a similar experience that 1950s readers had. And I don't believe they will because our culture has changed. So it's more about trying to get to the same, give readers ultimately, or viewers ultimately, the same experience that readers had when it first came out. And which sometimes means making changes.
We won't burn you at the stake. It's okay.
Okay. I'm really relieved. I hope
I did laugh because you emailed me, man, if we don't discuss this, they're going to burn us alive. I'm going, no, they're going to burn you alive. I had no part in this.
It would have been my fault. Yeah. I accept full responsibility for that.
Full responsibility.
Be angry at me.
But let's dive into the real book. And last time we left off, we actually kind of cut off discussion really a little bit before mm-hmm. the end of chapter 4, where we met...
We kept rambling.
Yeah. Well, we met two of our biggest characters. I re-met them. We got a whole new reintroduction, really. Almost as if we're meeting them for the first time, although Lewis throws in that little insert saying, well, if you read a book called The Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe, you would know that this is the same King Edmund, the same Queen Susan from that mm-hmm. book. And we really get that... The only image we really got of them like this was at the very end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They're fully a king and queen ruling mm-hmm. Narnia as siblings, which, of course, is also interesting that he uh-huh. points out again.
Yeah, I like that. He says that Shasta even reacts at one point and says, oh, wow, they're brother and sister, not husband and wife. And that's something that I've read 4.5 books at this point. I've accepted, oh, yes, of course, it's the four kings and queens
of
Narnia.
Yeah, to us it's not new. You don't think about
it
being weird.
Yeah, probably occurred to me the first time I read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but that was a little weird. But I've long since moved on from that. Yes, it's the four kings and queens, and Peter's mm-hmm. the High King. That's the way it is. That's so ingrained into the mythology of this world at this point. But for Shasta, it's new. And I love getting that perspective on old characters, kind of a chance to rediscover them again. I love the subtle way he does it. I mean, there's so many levels of disorientation. We talked about disorientation in the first part of the commentary, where first off, this strange guy, we don't even know who it is for a while. We don't know mm-hmm. it's Edmund. We just know some guy, I guess he's from Narnia, grabs Shasta and was like, oh, what is acting like he knows him. And where have you been, my lord? And why do you call me? What are you talking about? And then slowly, for the longest time, you don't know it's Edmund. And then I think Susan is the first one that's named. And that's when you put it together. Mm-hmm. So Lewis delays telling us exactly who it is. He just says it's some guy. So we have the experience along with Shasta of having no idea who it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I love it. And then again, like you said, Tumnus comes in, and that's a less subtle introduction. He actually says, oh, if you read a book called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you might want to know this is the same Fawn. So that's the most overt kind of mm-hmm. acknowledgement there. There's another subtle one. They reference the apple orchard. Did you catch that? They very briefly say, I can't remember who it is. One of the Pevensies says.
Oh, yeah, Susan. Wishing she were back in Narnia, and she mentions the apple orchard.
The apple orchard being planted, which, of course, is going to grow out of control in about 1,300 years when the Prince Caspian story starts. And that's a great little blink and you'll miss it kind of moment.
So what do you think we experience out of the story? What do we gain that we wouldn't before? Just getting kind of this reintroduction to them, other than... Because it's more... it's tempting to just kind of make it, oh, a cameo, especially in this day and age where we have movies and prequels and sequels and alternate timelines and like, oh, look, it's Logan sitting at the bar. Yeah, we'll see him, you know, kill people in the three movies earlier.
It doesn't add anything to this story, but hey, there it is.
Yeah.
I mean, not the horse and its boy. I was talking about like with superhero movies to have cameos and stuff. You got to pull out your phone and Google it. So you sort of questioning the value of like, what does this add to the story? Basically, having the Pevensies in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's again. First off, Lewis could have started the story in Narnia with characters we know. He intentionally chose to start it in Calorman with characters we don't know, that feeling of alienation. And I think we get, like him, I like that, Shasta is surprised that they're brother and sister and not husband and wife. And so we get a fresh perspective on characters we know. And then ultimately it does become tied into Shasta's story because, of course, Shasta's trying to get to Narnia. And then to suddenly, there's a sense of irony, and I guess, and ultimately you realize, oh, this is all Aslan's doing. Aslan's orchestrating all this, you know, spoiler alert. But Shasta's trying to get to Narnia and trying to get to this place where he can be free, and then he runs into these people, and oh man, like someone's going to try to, he doesn't know they're going to try to take over Narnia yet, but he knows they're worried that Susan might potentially be kidnapped and there could be war. And so this certainly concerns Shasta. Mm-hmm. So I think that it does add that to it, in addition to crossing over characters we already know, and suddenly the horse and his boy, which just seemed so far away from anything we'd seen before, all of a sudden, boom, it's now connected to something we do know, and Shasta's going to play a really important role in that.
Well,
I don't know. I'm rambling. Why don't you talk?
Well, no, it is. And I asked you because I kind of wondered myself, how does it really benefit the story? And one way it just, on a very simple structural level, benefits the story is the audience all of a sudden cares about a bigger plot. And it really is effective. And of course, these are characters you already know and love. And so, yeah, you get to see a new dimension to them. But it keeps the story from just being something that, you know, people just going along, going through the motions, and the audience is just expected to, oh, yeah, well, the good guys are on this side of this, you know, conflict, and so therefore I must care. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, honestly, if you throw the Millennium Falcon into a story, then all of a sudden the audience, oh, I don't want whoever's on it, I don't want the ship to blow up. I don't want it, you know, anyone on there to die. You know, because it's like, all of a sudden, boom, you have
But that's
some
not
kind
what's happening here.
Tech. You don't think? It keeps it from being just the Narnians. It's just the Narnians that we want.
Right.
Narnia
well,
to succeed.
I don't want to imply though that Lewis, that we don't have emotional investment, even apart from Narnia, we don't already have emotional investment in Shasta and the others at this point, and that they're just trying to inject some nostalgia to make us feel something.
No,
I think Lewis has earned, has made us fall in love with these new characters.
No, and I wasn't saying that you're not invested in Shasta, Nervous, and Brian Wynn. I was saying that you're invested then, but this expands the scope on a personal level. Because then you could say, the fate of Narnia is at stake. But it keeps it relational.
Right. Maybe most importantly, the story still, even if the horse and his boy, I suspect even if it is the first book you've read, yeah, maybe Lewis probably spends a little more time on kind of describing the Pevensies than he would have if they were just actually new characters.
Sure.
But I still think I still think the story holds up. You could read The Horse and His Boy as your first book. I think their place in the story still makes sense. Shasta's trying to get to Narnia, and whoa, apparently by coincidence, he's run into a king and queen from Narnia.
Well, and one of the reasons the books really work so well, because these are very short books. I mean, I'm sometimes still amazed. These are very short books. You can get through them very quickly. And I think one of the ways it works is the development of the characters. It's related to the actions that they take and the decisions they make. It's related, I mean, the fact that Shasta doesn't want to reveal exactly what's going on, because it's kind of like the how it should have ended moment. Hey, I'm from Narnia, I think, and all my friends are, we're trying to get back there. It'd be really convenient if you just took us back. Oh, yeah, that'd be nice. Later, let's cut out a third of the book, you know? And you could say that that's a plot hole, but here that actual decision has a rationale behind it. And it's because that's explained. And so his decision, But it's not just a decision that the character makes that propels the story and changes the course of the story. Why? Why does Shasta make that decision? Well, it's because of this insecurity in his upbringing and how he can't trust anyone. Bree is the first person right. He's ever come close to trusting.
There's that great line about, you know, he avoided trusting grown-ups if he could possibly do it because he was always sure they were going to spoil the fun or make him do something he didn't want to do. But see, it's interesting, like now in retrospect, having thought about it, it does seem like kind of, wow, Shasta could have just said, and Bree for that matter, could have maybe spoken up and just said, hey, I'm from Narnia, help me out here. You know, I was kidnapped a long time ago and Shasta could have said something like that and could have gotten a free ride to Narnia. Now we know that, knowing the Pevensies, but it's understandable that Shasta, even though he's trying to get to Narnia, would still be afraid of these important sounding grownups. And the amazing part is that I totally relate to it. It's certainly reading it the first time. I personally, even though I know that it's Edmund, it's Susan, I'm sure it would be okay. I still completely understand where Shasta's coming from. I'm so invested in seeing things from his point of view that I don't really find myself getting too caught up in, oh, Shasta, just tell them. Some people are reading this book and they're just shouting at the page, Shasta, just tell them who you are or whatever. But I don't. I'm so into Shasta's headspace.
And you get the awkwardness of, oh, shoot, now that I've been going along with this thing where they think I'm someone that they know, now it's going to be really awkward. Like, hey, you actually have no clue who I am and I've never seen any of you before. I mean, you get the awkwardness of how, like, oh, maybe I just don't say anything. It works because, of course, the characters are developed through their decisions and the rationale behind their decisions. So it's not just that, oh, yeah, because he made that decision and you learn a bit about it, it reveals a whole new dimension to his character, or at least deepens one that you already suspected. And can I just say, I like that it's not just a, hey, let's just fight our way out of here. Kind of, because if you're making like a modern action movie, you'd say, oh, this is a really good idea for an action scene where they'll fight their way out, fight their way to the ship.
Where the Narnians fight their way and they defeat Rabadash
and
they get Susan back.
And then Shasta will get
separated,
and that's how we'll reunite, which frankly is probably how they would do it at the movie.
And they even entertain that idea for a moment. There's a few Narnians that are, well, this house is reasonably defensible. Isn't it Edmund who is known for being wise? And Discord says, well, at the end, we're just gonna be, what do they say, like rats fighting in a trap or something like that. And like at the end they would just set fire to the house. Okay, let's get onto something more rational. And then the plan is really, really smart. And we're gonna see when we get to a couple chapters from now how the Tisrock and Rabadash completely misunderstand the way Narnians would approach something and think about something. I hope they don't put the Pevensies on the poster for the Horseman's Boy when they make the movie. And have them being really prominent in trailers. And frankly, I hope they don't make them too prominent in the movie. That's a concern, too.
Yeah. Well, if there ever is a movie, we'll see. But
yes,
we have another interesting moment here where we have another, actually a major character who's introduced here. And I have to ask, which character? We meet Prince Corrin, who, of course, is the alter ego, the real prince, who, of course, they mistake. And he's, comes in and he's all roughed up and he's had a rough go and really gives this hilarious account of his day and how just really nonchalantly knocked him down, and then he came back, so I knocked him down again. Which character do you like better?
I mean,
obviously
one is the
one that's more of the sympathetic character, but I mean,
it's hard to say. I'm so invested in Shasta at this point. I mean, he's my guy. I'm so with him. It's not a fair comparison. I find Corrin really funny. If you mean there's a difference between a character. Like, I think the Joker is, I like that character, but I wouldn't want to have dinner with him. I would say, but in both cases, though, I think Shasta, just because you spend more time with him, I guess, has more layers to him and more things happening. And Corrin, although I find him really funny and a great contrast to who Shasta is, because he's sort of an image
sure
of Shasta.
Himself.
I wonder if Shasta, we'll talk about this. I'll get to this and when we get to a later chapter. But Corrin's kind of an image of what Shasta might have become if he hadn't been kidnapped. Mm-hmm. In the same way that Lasserlane's kind of an image of what Erebus could have become.
I hadn't thought of that.
And I wonder if Shasta became a better ultimately Kor became a better king, having grown up in, I think, as if he had been like Corrin and, oh, I knocked him down and being like that, that would have been a very different future for Arkham. Yeah, they would have had a very different king.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know which one I like more, I love what Corrin does for the story, for sure. It'll be really interesting to see how they handle twins in the movie, if they do that. Presumably, they'd have to have the same actor play both characters, because they have to be absolutely identical. There's no way around that.
Frankly, it's just easier logistically than, I mean, the Harry Potter films had that rare opportunity where they had those twins that look just like the Weasley brothers. I mean, it's like they look like brothers.
But they didn't have to carry the movie. They were gags.
No, they didn't.
You know, they just had to deliver the occasional joke. I mean, this actor would have to carry the movie.
Oh, as you're saying, they probably have to have. It's hard to find two good actors that are twins.
So you got the same actor play both. Now, obviously, they can't do that in a play, though. For the Horse and His Boy stage adaptation at the Logos Theater next year, they can't have the same actor play both roles in a play. So that's going to be a really interesting challenge, how they approach that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we continue with Shasta, and eventually he, of course, escapes and doesn't tell the Narnians, and basically just says, just tell them what's going to happen by after I leave. And, you know,
which of course, and Corrin's like, well, what else would I tell them?
Like, what else am I going to say?
I love that.
So I love that part. And then, of course, Shasta finally makes it to the tombs.
Again, we talked about this before. These are fantasy characters, but they're experiencing things that, oh my gosh, I've totally experienced that before. Shasta has this, I mean, just irrational fear of the dark openings in the tombs and the ghouls. Of course, there aren't actually ghouls. And I love the fact that he feels that, and Lewis doesn't talk down to that fear. He acknowledges, he says, oh, if Shasta had been a more sensible boy, he would have, you know, gone closer to the city where there'd be less likely to be wild beasts. This is when Shasta wakes up in the middle of the night, of course, and he's hearing the jackals. And Shasta feels he'd rather risk the jackals than the ghouls that deep down he knows probably don't exist. Or to walk down those scary openings. And I think the tone of the narrator is saying that he's taking this as a serious fear. He's not saying, oh, silly Shasta. He's saying this is a really difficult choice Shasta's having to make. Do I risk those scary dark openings and those imaginary ghouls, or do I risk the wild beasts? He's kind of acknowledging this as a legitimate difficult choice. I appreciate that, because there's such a tendency in our culture, I think, to talk down to children, and to talk down to a child is stressed out because learning how to tie their shoes, or someone pushed me at school and I don't know what to do about it. Well, as an adult, I've long since kind of learned how to deal with these things. It's easy for me. But for a kid, it's their first time. And so it is serious. And I don't want to go off too much of a tangent, but I'll briefly give a shout out to the Where the Wild Things Are movie, directed by Spike Jonze, who was the director I endorsed to direct a Narnia movie. There's a great scene where Max, the main character in the movie, is talking about why he ran away from home, and he tells one of the wild things, I don't like frozen corn. And it's not funny. The wild thing looks at him and says, I'm sorry. It's a completely serious moment, because for him as a little kid, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I like how the movie, or the Horse and His Boy book, doesn't talk down to the emotions you feel when you're just a kid.
Yeah, well, and it's an interesting way of acknowledging the emotions, because you know, whenever you're dealing with conflict in life or real stress, you're feeling those emotions. And you might know in the back of your mind, look, I know that this is just, you know, like I remember, you know, whether it was, you know, just growing up, it might have been a breakup or anxiety about, you know, getting a job, which, you know, that job I had anxiety over was whether I was going to be able to work at a restaurant, you know, or college classes or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, whether you're a teenager, a young adult, a kid, or even an adult, the scale of the problem, but you're feeling those emotions. You're feeling that stress. And that stress is a very real factor in your life, even though you can sometimes pull yourself back and say, yeah, I know that this will probably work itself out. It's okay. But my grasp on reality doesn't change the fact that I'm really feeling this intensely right now. And
It's a challenge to overcome it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, not only that, but you're, as a reader, you're thinking, okay, yeah, there's no ghouls, Shasta. And you were just talking earlier to Erebus about how you don't believe in ghouls. And and knowing the world of Narnia, thinking, okay, there's probably no ghouls here. But then you're thinking, oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't like creepy open tombs. And
it's still a difficult choice. Yeah. I think that's something that, again, I don't have any kids yet, but, and again, parents, post a comment. Tell me what you think of this. I don't know what I'm talking about, but... that's something where when I have kids, one of the priorities I think I want to have is to don't be too quick to dismiss struggles they're having that, of course, for me would be really easy, but for them is stressful and traumatic in the moment because this is, and they have to, as a kid, I guess you have to go through that. You have to go through that trauma and that stress of, oh, what do I do? And then eventually you learn to overcome it. Don't talk down to that. Take it seriously. Look them in the eye and acknowledge the seriousness of what they're feeling. There's something to be said about putting it in perspective, like, hey, look, you'll be fine, okay? But get down, you know, go down to their level and acknowledge what they're feeling is serious. Don't just dismiss it.
Well, it's a challenge.
I hope to make that a priority when I'm a parent.
Because you have to, like you're saying, and I agree, you have to acknowledge that emotion. That, hey, I know this is what you're feeling, and I know it feels really bad. And then after you acknowledge that, you can address what that reaction is to. And one thing that's kind of interesting here is, I am, full disclosure, not a cat person. I'm a dog person. I like my cat. It's like, if I have a cat, I like that cat. But I'm not going to like just, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, just some random kitty, you know? I don't really care.
I'm not either, but I'll go with cats over dogs.
I guess there's a reason that we play opposite each other in this podcast.
Good that we have equal representation here.
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, but, you know... I can imagine myself in Shasta's position here, and it's so weird because you think, on one hand, you think, hey, it's just a cat. It's just a cat that's close to him. It doesn't, uh-huh. You know, he knows it's not going to defend him from the jackals. He knows it's not going to defend him from the ghouls. But you just realize, you know, that would comfort me too, just having something else there, something else to look, who has eyes you can look into. And you realize, oh, that's something. It's just interesting how Lewis picks up on, yeah, this is a very small thing. It doesn't really practically help him, although it actually it's helping him practically in ways he doesn't understand. But you really you get it as a reader.
I love, it's so easy to relate to that little thing Lewis says about when you're afraid. There's nothing like having your back to something, you know, warm and your face to the danger. And that's a little human thing. Oh, I never would have thought to articulate that, but yeah, I relate to that. In the middle of this fantasy world and fantasy characters, this character's feeling something that, oh, I feel that too. I never would have thought to even express it that way. Well, it makes me believe in the world.
It's interesting how at every step, I'm thinking, I haven't prepared these thoughts because they're just coming to me as we're discussing. But at every step, Shasta is not a really particularly brave character, but at each step in the story, he becomes a little more brave. He faces things that he would not have really in the previous chapter seen himself facing. Even in this chapter, he doesn't want to have to, you know, deal with tombs. He'd rather face the jackals than the ghouls. And step by step, you know, here he's got his back to the cat, which is comforting him, but he's facing the tombs.
Yeah.
And that's just a little bit better. And of course, eventually, you know, he faces bigger and bigger challenges that he couldn't have imagined himself facing earlier. But,
right. And then it turns out to be Aslan. We'll find out later.
And talk about the stump question that you asked earlier, because we were just discussing this on which book Aslan's name is mentioned the least in.
Oh, darn it. I wanted to go find it. I didn't end up pulling it up. But, you know, because I asked David McGee, Silverchair screenwriter, you know, the trivia question, which Narnia book has the name of Aslan the most number of times? And the answer was The Last Battle, followed very closely by Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I remember Horson's Boy was, I think it might have been at the bottom. It was definitely I don't know if it was at the very bottom. It might have been. It was very close to the bottom of the name of Aslan said the fewest number of times. But so when you first read it, and again, there's so many unfamiliar characters. It's an unfamiliar environment in so many ways. And conspicuously, where's Aslan? They even had some lion characters in it. Like, oh yeah, just a random lion. It's nothing, apparently. It feels like Aslan isn't in this book at all. And then in retrospect, you realize Aslan probably has a more direct role in this book than maybe then in any other of the books.
Yeah, and I asked,
spoiler alert,
just going over our outline, I asked, does this book highlight the providential role of Aslan more than any other book? And I think in terms of the concept of Aslan being a character that orchestrates things and brings things together and weaves this story the way that he wants it to be told, I think that this is really maybe the number one example of him guiding certain characters here and there in ways that they at the time have no idea, although later uh-huh. they'll come to understand. I think that that's one of the things uh-huh. that this book highlights more than the others. I mean, you see it here and there, especially in the books like The Silver Chair. But in this one, it takes on a role. I mean, he's taking on the forms of other creatures that he didn't before. And mm-hmm. and his power is no less diminished as a character. I mean, he's still presumably yeah. tearing jackals apart, or at least scaring them witless.
Right. And we'll have some more thoughts on that, but I guess I can save him for several chapters from now when we finally get to the unwelcome fellow traveler.
Oh, I love that chapter. That's mm-hmm. my favorite chapter title.
Not yet.
I know.
We'll save it.
I know. We'll save it for next time.
We are well north of the 30-minute mark.
That is true. And it is time for you to be stumped, my friend. But first, we're going to listen to Voices of Narnia Web and our C.S. Lewis Minute. And we'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hello from Indiana. My name is Julia, but here I'm known as Anne Finwen. The name comes from Tolkien's Elvish and means long-haired maiden. I first found Narnia Web when I was looking for news about the upcoming Voyage of the Dawn Treader movie. Like many others, I stayed on the front page for a long time before finally venturing back into the forums and then joining in 2011 under the name The Lady Arwen Undomiel. My first introduction to Narnia was through my mom. She read the books aloud to myself and my siblings, but I was really, really young at the time and I don't remember them all that well. So I'd have to say my first real introduction was through the Focus on the Family radio theater audio dramas. They're what really made me love Narnia. My favorite book is The Horse and His Boy. It just really stands out from the rest of the Chronicles when you look at them as a whole. The tone is different and the plot style is a bit different. And I love the glimpse it gives us of the Golden Age of Narnia. It's always so special to get to see the Pevensies during that period of their lives. My second favorite book would probably be The Magician's Nephew. It's a really close second. I love how deep it is, and yet it has this very fanciful and fairy tale-like quality without losing its emotional impact. My favorite character is Erebus, naturally, since my favorite book is The Horse and His Boy. She's such a strong but deep character, and she has her flaws but slowly overcomes them throughout the story. I love that we as the readers can relate to her in a way because we also long to go to Narnia. My second favorite character would be Edmund because he also has this amazing journey throughout the books. While I really love the Narnia books, Narnia Web itself is special to me because it is full of kind and thoughtful people. Since we live in an age of online bullying and trolling, that makes it a really, really special place. And I want to say a great big thank you to all the moderators and those who keep this site running. We really appreciate it.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Last segment, I spoke about the second of three books from C.S. Lewis's science fiction series. Now let's wrap up by focusing on the final title, That Hideous Strength. Unlike the previous works, Elwyn Ransom is not the central character. While he is present, the main events center around a husband and wife, Mark and Jane Studdock. The struggle between good and evil occurs again, but this time it's on Earth, and the married couple is not on the same team. There's an organization with the initials NICE, which spells NICE, of course. It stands for National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, And well, it's not long before you discover the people there are not so nice. Plus, things get real interesting when a guy named Merlin shows up. But you'll have to read That Hideous Strength to learn the details. Discover more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
And we are back. Glumpuddle.
Yes, we are.
Are you ready to be stumped?
Do your worst.
Here was the question. Okay, in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Chapter 10, Lucy is reading the magician's book and she comes across a story. It's an incredible story and she tries to turn the pages back after she's read it, but she can't. And then she's trying frantically to remember the story. And all she can remember are little pieces of the story. And there are four elements to the story that she is able to remember. What are those four story elements? And there are four layers of hints if you need hints.
So in other words, I can ask for a hint and then say, have another hint and then another hint, basically?
Yes, and our respect for you will diminish less and less and less.
Right,
and less.
Okay. That's
how it works.
So there's four little glimpses. It's, you know, kind of similar, I guess, to when you wake up from a dream. And you can remember it very vividly, and in some ways you have totally forgotten it. And you can't even describe it to anyone else what it's like. And that idea of Lucy read a story that... she know whenever she reads a story that she loves, it's one that, like, for the rest of her life, it will be one that reminds her of the forgotten story in the magician's book. And I think I've always thought Lewis is getting at there, that is it possible that even fantasy stories, the stories we love the most, maybe whether we're consciously aware of it or not, we love them because they remind us of a true story, because they resonate with something that's actually true. But what were the glimpses? So there were four. There were four things, right?
Yep.
That she could remember. There was a sword, a cup, and a green hill, and I think those were three of them. It's the fourth one. I don't know if I can remember. Let me think here for a second. It was a sword and a cup and a green hill. Was it like a person or something? Sword. That's a weapon. A cup. A green hill. Oh, I'm going to hate myself when you tell me. I can't remember what the fourth one was. So I'm going to blow Queen Susan's horn and ask for help here. Go ahead and give me one of the hints.
One of these story elements is alive.
Is it, I'm going to say, maybe a knight or a king? I'm going to go with a knight as the fourth one. I'll make that my final answer.
That is incorrect.
What is it?
Four items are a cup, a sword, a green hill, and a tree.
A tree, all that kind of alive. Okay, that still works.
Sorry.
I was pretty close.
I was reading
a knight and a tree, they're pretty much the same thing. Kind of ironic that, like, I felt like I could see it in my head, words on the page, and I couldn't remember exactly what they were, kind of like what Lucy is experiencing.
Yeah,
so
exactly. So now we can relate to Lucy, even in our failure.
Imagine that. All right. This is a long one, but we'll continue our Horses Boy commentary next week. Please keep posting comments.
Indeed.
And give me the outro.
I know. I was switching back to the other page. So, you've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniaWeb.com, Rillian@NarniaWeb.com, or Glumpuddle@NarniaWeb.com. Special thanks to AJ Aiken, Readian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silverchair movie, visit NarniaWeb.com. A new episode of Talking Beasts is posted every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.